A Message from Leading Into Tomorrow by EY. Dive into our mini-series, Granting the Future, for conversations with public sector leaders revolutionizing grant distribution worldwide. Gain valuable insights into innovative strategies and best practices, and discover how grants are shaping the future of public service delivery. Download the Leading Into Tomorrow podcast series today, available on all major platforms.
As the stage is set for a Biden-Trump rematch, more Republicans giving their endorsement, including those who once ran for the job themselves.
Like, and this morning, Miami Mayor Francis Suarez posted this statement on X. In it, he says, after seeing both President Biden and former President Trump at the border yesterday, he is endorsing Donald Trump for president.
Donald Trump is all but certain now to lead his party into November's presidential election. So it's make up your mind time for Republicans. Are they with him or not? One of them is a big gun in Florida politics, the mayor of Miami, Francis Suarez. Welcome to Power Play from Politico, the podcast where we talk to some of the world's most influential figures on both sides of the Atlantic. I'm Anne McElvoy, and this week I'm in Miami, Florida, to test the temperature in a state that's traditionally held the keys to the White House. In recent years, it's definitely lent more towards the Republicans, but this year in particular, it's a state where every vote will count come November. The son of Miami's first Cuban-born mayor, Francis Suarez, earned a national profile by briefly entering the race for the White House last year, before dropping out as the Trump bandwagon rumbled on. He's also gained wider attention in recent years for his efforts to lure companies to Miami, with an eye on turning the city into a major crypto hub, and perhaps the next Silicon Valley too. As Donald Trump sizes up the contest with President Biden, why has a charismatic, moderate Republican thrown in his lot with a candidate he previously opposed and even ran against in the recent primaries? Francis Suarez, welcome to Power Play.
Thank you so much. Well, thank you for having me.
You've been mayor of Miami since 2017. I interviewed you, but then you were re-elected in 2021. You also ran a short-lived campaign to be the Republican presidential candidate last year.
Yep.
What's your plan now then? Do you have your sights on state and national politics?
For me, if I decide to stay involved in politics and I'm in year 15, the things that would engage me and that I would be challenged by would be potentially running for governor in 26, right? My term ends in 25. And then, you know, there's a possibility if the former president is elected, and I just recently endorsed him a few weeks ago, of potentially working in his government, depending on what the position would be. Look, I mean, whatever I do, it's got to be something that for me allows me to really, really focus on a mission. My mission has been building what I consider to be the greatest ecosystem on the planet in the city of Miami. Florida has a phenomenal ecosystem. It would be like a G20 country, right? A $1.5 trillion GDP, 20 million people, and a $100 billion budget. And of course, you know, working in a federal government would allow me to have a large impact on a lot of people.
So there's quite a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
Let's go first towards that idea of the governor race in 2026. It's a way off. People are talking about it. It seems like you're talking about it. What would you want to bring to that? And in a sense, you seem to say, like, you might like that, but you might like the federal role as well. Well, you have to sort of choose where you're pointing yourself.
Yeah, you sort of do. I mean, in one case, you're chosen, right? In the case of working for a government, the person who would be elected presumably would choose you, and presumably you would accept, right? And then, of course, depending on the role, there's a confirmation process. So that's one possible fork in the road. The other one is running for governor. And, you know, running for governor is a $100 million race plus in terms of fundraising. I've always excelled at that. That's never been something that I've struggled with. But I think for me, you know, what's interesting about it is it's an executive role as opposed to, let's say, congressional role, senatorial role, which are both legislative in nature. And that's an area where I've thrived in, you know, as mayor, you know, creating an ecosystem, trying to build a place that delivers on the promise of prosperity for the maximum number of people. And I think when you're an executive, you're not just running what I call the corporation, or you're not just running the government. which is a $100 billion enterprise. You're really running the ecosystem, which is a $1.5 trillion ecosystem. So I think that's my view of it. And I think if I were to decide to run for that, I think, you know, the Miami ecosystem that we built would be a wonderful credential, if you will, right? For someone to say, hey, this guy has done it in a place where when he got here, it was bankrupt. You know, in the 80s, it was crime ridden and it was poor. And he's turned around all those major factors in creating what is arguably one of the most dynamic ecosystems in the world.
The kind of conservatism that you espouse would be very different, wouldn't it, from Ron DeSantis and the way that he has expressed himself recently as governor. Do you see yourself as a contrast to that kind of culture wars, somewhat fire and fury brand of politics?
I think the fact that I've spent a significant amount of time in the private sector, and I think our governor, who has been in elected office essentially, you know, a lot of his adult life, that in and of itself is a contrast, right? Like, I focused on reducing taxes, for example. I lowered taxes to the lowest level in history. And then we saw unprecedented growth because I believe that smaller government allows the private sector to grow based on its own decisions. And so that has been a great predicate for how to run a government. At the same time, we've done it in a fiscally responsible way, right? We haven't cut services. On the contrary, we've actually grown the size of our budget through growth, not through tax policy. And so we have the highest bond rating in history, the highest reserves in history, while having the lowest tax rate ever. And so I think that is the mark of good conservative fiscal policy. And so we've done that.
I am going to come back to your record as mayor, where we've got a lot of time to dig into that. My question was actually to what extent you saw yourself as a contrasting figure. We were talking about possibly you running in the governor race.
Yeah.
To Ron DeSantis' form of conservatism. Because one thing I want to dive into with you is, what is it now to be an American Republican, whether it's your endorsement of Donald Trump? But let's just stay for a moment on DeSantis.
Yeah. I think we're all individuals, so we all have our own styles. And I don't think that anybody can be another Donald Trump. And I'm not so sure that anybody could be another Ron DeSantis. They have a very distinct style, personality, and I have my own. I'm not the same as my father. You know, my father has his own personality, his own style. So I don't like to define myself by contrasting myself to somebody. I like to define myself by saying who I am.
It's about a week and a half or so since you endorsed Donald Trump as the Republican nominee. After you met with him at the border, you said he's the only candidate who will keep our country safe, our border secured, reduce inflation, and can coherently lead the country forward. But you didn't want him to be the nominee in 2016 or indeed in 2020. What's changed?
What's changed is he was president for 4 years and the current president has been president for 4 years. And it's probably the first time or one of the few times in the history of this country where you get to see a four-year snapshot in making the decision on who should be the president of the United States. And so I think what that does for me is it takes away the people who don't like the former president, don't like aspects of his personality. The people that don't like the current president don't like what they believe to be someone whose mind is not as sharp as it should be or may not like his judgment. My view is you don't even have to get into that arena so much because that can be somewhat distracting. All you have to do is analyze the 4 years that they've had. So in the case of the current president, when you look at immigration, you've had 7.2 million people come into this country without legal status. And that is greater than the population of 37 states in America. That's something that Democratic mayors are complaining about, not just Republicans.
But hold on a minute. I mean, 2018, you actually did go to Texas to protest against Donald Trump's family separation policies, and you said you were horrified that there were children who can't sleep with their parents tonight. Well, there is not, as it stands, at least as I understand it, a recipe for a prospective Trump presidency that would stop that happening again. But nonetheless, you have endorsed.
So you're picking on one specific issue, and I'm talking about the dysfunction that is the border that now has become a bipartisan issue that both parties agree on. You're talking about 7 million people in 4 years, and there is, I think it's 70 or 80,000 people that have died of fentanyl deaths that is infiltrated in our southern border, right? That is the equivalent of a 747 crashing every single day. So that's just on the border. I even think the president himself would acknowledge or is now starting to take the border seriously. I think, frankly, the president I think he underestimated what a big issue this would be. Certainly in a presidential year, it's become arguably the number one issue in the American conscience.
Let's look back to that border crisis, because when you ran as the nominee last summer, you said that as a Hispanic Republican, you'd be in a unique position to help solve that multi-decade, multi-administration immigration crisis. But you don't favor a quick path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. That's one way that you could do it. I'm imagining you're the biggest fan of the old kind of dreamers idea that seemed to sort of slightly fade out with the end and beyond the Obama presidency. Just broadly speaking, what would you do?
To me, it's multi-pronged. So I think you have to start, I think all solutions start with securing the border. And, you know, for example, remain in Mexico, which was a much better policy than catch and release. That would have solved 70% of what we're seeing in terms of the massive migration crisis right now. You know, continuing the border wall and reinforcing the border agent's ability to have the technology and the resources to keep our border secure, I think is the starting point. Then I think you have to look at some of the root causes. So you have a $400 or $500 billion annual trade deficit with China. And I would look to nearshore, not just in terms of domestic production, but also in terms of hemispheric production of our supply chain. We saw during COVID how vulnerable our supply chain is and how dependent it is on China, which has become an increasing adversary. I think there's a great opportunity to nearshore some of that, create robust partnerships and create robust alliances in our hemisphere, which would make our supply chain safer, but also allow us to create prosperity in the region. We're seeing the rise in left or socialist sort of communist regimes in our hemisphere, which I think creates more poverty, which creates more immigration pressure on the U.S. So I think that would depressure, you know, immigration. It would create prosperity. Number three, I think you have to increase legal immigration.
So and I think do you favor a rise in legal immigration?
Oh, yeah.
Can you give me a sense of to what extent?
Sure. And to me, it's not so much a number per se as it is a set of metrics, right? So I think it would have to be objective metrics. Like, for example, we have a declining birth rate. We would have a targeted growth rate. We have an unemployment rate. We have a certain need for skilled and unskilled labor because every market's different and every market has different needs. So I think all of those objective criteria should be utilized to create a formula that can ebb and flow with time. This should be a moving target that flows with objective metrics that benefit our country. So that would be number three. Number four would be, what do you do with when you call, you know, the undocumented? There's a lot of different terminology now that's floating around. But I think the key is people who did not follow the rules, right, or who got into this country without becoming legal citizens should not have a preference over people who did. I do think when you expand legal immigration, you solve a lot of that.
Here's something that I think will interest our broader audience way beyond Florida and even outside the U.S. You're a young, very urban leader of this vibrant city of Miami. You've attracted Democrats to vote for you. It's always great to get crossover votes. That's the currency in politics.
Amen.
Now, you've now thrown your lot in, as have a lot of other Republicans, with Donald Trump, who it would be fair to say is, at the very least, a divisive figure in American politics, and he repels many independents and swing voters. Can I just be honest with you and say, are you really just doing this because you think, well, he's there anyway, and it's going to happen, so we're all on board the Trump Express?
Well, I would disagree with the last part of your comment where you took
it. You might.
It's okay. With you know, repelling independents and moderate voters, because if you look at Miami-Dade County, it's a microcosm, right? When I got elected mayor in 2017, in 2016, he lost Miami-Dade County to Hillary Clinton by 30 points. Now, Miami-Dade County is a third, a third, a third. In fact, Republicans make up the smallest third of the three thirds, okay? So Republicans are the least largest registered block of the three. So in 2016, he loses Miami-Dade County by 30 points, which would sort of support your statement, your current statement. Mm-hmm. In 2022, the last midterms, Republicans won Miami-Dade County by plus 12. That is a 40-point swing. And in 2020, he lost it to Joe Biden by 8. So it went from 30 to 8. So that's a 22-point difference. From 8 to 12, that's another 20-point difference. So I think I disagree. And if you look at national polling right now, he's winning just about every single national poll head-to-head against Joe Biden, which to win, you have to be able to get independents.
Has something been lost in the liberal end of the Republican spectrum. I'm thinking of your action on climate change, your public support and encouragement even of LGBT pride events. There was, you know, these aren't things that sit very comfortably with the broader Donald Trump philosophy and ideology.
I think Donald Trump has been very pro-LGBT community, if you've looked at his pronouncements. You know, and on climate, I think the issue is, we like to say here in Miami that the environment is the economy, right? So there cannot be a juxtaposition between environmental policy and economic policy. And I think the problem is that there are a lot on the left who are social engineering via an environment policy, right? When you look at the Green New Deal, it's really a socialist sort of reengineering of government using the environment as a proxy.
You mentioned earlier you might like to serve and to be around in federal government or the administration. So what's your dream job under Donald Trump if he indeed makes it to the White House?
It's funny. I don't pigeonhole myself or think of it one specific thing or another. You know, obviously representing the United States in an ambassadorial capacity is always something that has intrigued me. You know, having a cabinet level position is intriguing. There's precedent for both. You know, you have the U.S. ambassador to Japan was a former mayor of Chicago. The U.S. ambassador to India right now is a former mayor.
Yes, indeed. And a former interviewee, I have to say. I do pick all the good mayors.
Yeah, I'm
a good mayor.
I will not disagree with you on that. And then, of course, you have, you know, Secretary of Transportation now as a former mayor.
What about running mate, then? Is that within your purview or hopes that the phone rings in it?
Yeah, I've been very transparent about it. You know, I think most people, if they didn't tell you that they'd be honored to be the vice president, they're probably not telling you the truth. And in this particular case, more than any, because it's a one-term presidency no matter what, right? So that person would have at least a credible opportunity to run for president in the upcoming election. And I think that anyone who's run for president would tell you that they certainly would welcome another opportunity with different dynamics, right? Like in my case, I think I had the right personality. I think I had a great something to offer, but I didn't have volume, right? I didn't have the volume that some of my opponents had.
What did you learn from the race? I mean, you were obviously, you know, you were coming in as a bit of an outsider.
Totally.
You did have to then take your brand of politics outside the comfort zone, perhaps outside Miami, outside Florida. What's the big learning point for you?
So much. I mean, we could do an interview just on that. I'll keep it short. Basically, I learned to believe in the American people and in their decision making, because they are very, very prepared. And they give people an opportunity. They're open. I also learned the kind of volume that it takes. And it's very hard to be a disruptor and an outsider if you're not given an opportunity to have volume. And I think even people who have been mayors that have run have been given a chance. And I think, you know, my case, maybe running in a state where my governor was running, you know, took up a lot of the oxygen.
We'll be back after this break for more on the national political outlook and what has Mayor Suarez got planned for Miami.
A message from Leading Into Tomorrow by EY. Dive into our miniseries, Granting the Future, which explores how governments and organizations distribute trillions of dollars in grants to tackle urgent international challenges and deliver on domestic priorities. Join us for inspiring conversations with public sector leaders who are revolutionizing grant distribution worldwide by using technology to navigate complex environments and optimize outcomes. Gain valuable insights into innovative strategies and best practices, and discover how grants are shaping the future of public service delivery. Download the Leading Into Tomorrow podcast series today, available on all major platforms. Join us in shaping the future of public service delivery. Your journey into innovation and impact starts now.
We're sitting here in your rather attractive offices, former Hanam Seaplane Terminal. It's definitely a very different vibe to a lot of city halls that I've been in.
It's got a panoramic view of the third largest skyline in America, which is after New York and Chicago, and I'll show it to you in a minute. And, you know, it's interesting. Our view symbolizes or replicates our logo, which is palm trees, ocean, and then the horizon.
That's that does it for me. It's a Brit coming in March, I can tell you. You know,
yeah.
Like, you know, Miami had me at hello. You made it one of your big missions to attract talent and investment to the city, especially in tech and finance. That's really become very much part of your brand. And the billionaire Ken Griffin made a big splash when he said that his giant hedge fund, Citadel, was moving from Chicago to Miami. The plans are taking place. He calls it Wall Street South. What is it, do you think, that beats the grand old cities of finance like Manhattan and Chicago? And why, if you were a British financier, maybe from London, or a German from Frankfurt, or a Swiss, would you come here?
It's our attitude. How can I help? Like, our attitude is embodied in that phrase, and it is very counter to the attitude of other American cities right now that are basically making it impossible, if not kicking out outright, innovators and doers. So if you look at the example of New York winning the Amazon HQ2 prize and then the state saying, no, thank you, it's not just about kicking out the company. It's about the signaling effect. You built a trillion-dollar company. We competed for your headquarters. We won the competition. And then we said no. And in the same thing in California, where you had someone say F Elon Musk and kicked out essentially Elon Musk, it's not about Elon Musk per se. It's about the signaling effect of kicking out one of the most innovative people in the world, right? And so he left to another market and opened up in a gigafactory in Austin. So I think for us, we were answering the question of what if we move Silicon Valley to Miami with a simple response of how can I help? Meaning our attitude was different. We wanted to take advantage of the tsunami of opportunity that was coming from this transition from an industrial economy to a digital economy. And we realized that to do that, we had to be aggressive. We had to position ourselves. It was a little bit of a David and Goliath type of moment.
So tell me how you would respond then to that tension that there can sometimes be between, like, we're open to business, we want all kinds of business. And then there's more local considerations. I was thinking there about that standoff that Ron DeSantis ended up in over his argument with Disney on that, that decision that he took there. Well, he called it a war on woke. It ended up removing Disney's special status as an amusement park after the company criticized a state law that restricted the teaching of sexuality in schools. This is complicated, but it all matters. And you said then that was a mistake, perhaps a personal vendetta. It had cost the state potentially 2,000 jobs in a $1 billion investment. Is that a position you stand by? And what would you now do about that?
Yeah, and I think it does go to something, a point where we are different. And you sort of alluded to this at the beginning, and I'd highlight there are differences in our approach, right? I'm much more pragmatic. I've also spent a lot of time in the private sector. And I think that also influences my approach. I think what I would have done is a little different, right? I think he could have banked the win of getting them to back down on opposing his policy of not teaching sexuality in public schools to young children, and not gone beyond that. I think there's a place where you could have a kumbaya moment with the CEO, whoever that may be at the time, and say, hey, look, we agree we're not gonna get involved in this, and the governor agrees he's not gonna penalize us or make it personal. And then you come and you announce a big investment, right? You know, that's where statesmanship is important.
So you would be reaching back out to Disney, it sounds like.
I would have certainly tried to broker a solution that I think would have gotten what I wanted, which was, which he ultimately got, right? A win on the policy. And then without going so far as to fight with really not just a company or a CEO or a C-suite executive, you're talking about your largest employer in your state, right? With 80,000 employees. And I wouldn't want to do something that would let them go to sleep at night wondering whether their jobs were safe.
Some clouds on the horizon for you as mayor. You're under several ongoing investigations for potential conflicts of interest. What can you tell us about where those stand and what you think the result will be?
Yeah, I mean, they're not several. I can tell you that much. There is one that will be decided shortly, and you'll get an indication on that. And then another one that...
You could always just spoil the suspense and tell us.
I'm not going to spoil the suspense and tell you. But there will be a decision that will be announced soon. And then I think there's one pending.
Can I just check in? Is that the federal criminal investigation that's into the alleged payments received from the...
I'm not aware of any federal criminal investigation. So that's something that is, as far as I'm concerned, manufactured by a local media outlet. I have not been contacted by any federal officials regarding any sort of federal criminal investigation. So I'm not so sure where they got that from, where that's sourced from.
So that was actually the question I was going to ask. So we got that out of the way in the sense that federal investigators haven't been in contact with you?
No.
In that case, what is this next step of this story that you're tantalizing us with?
That's a Florida Commission on Ethics, ethical complaint that was. So this has become very political and basically been, I know you're shocked to hear that, right? Someone weaponizing articles that I think are unfortunately not well researched. And draw improper conclusions from the facts. and have been weaponized by political actors, you know, in an effort to...
But this is at the very least inconvenient to you. So what is it that you want?
It is never convenient to anyone who's in public service for their integrity to be questioned. I don't care who they are. I don't know of a human being who's in public service that would ever say it's convenient. But that's the purpose. The purpose is to inconvenience me. The purpose is to besmirch me because we are succeeding. And if someone is succeeding and they have a certain brand and they have a certain philosophy and ideology, then those who oppose that philosophy and ideology are threatened. And so that this is their answer, to try to discredit the person. And that's what they've been trying to do. And I think they're going to be unsuccessful. And I look forward to that part of it.
So you, as you were putting it, do you have a case to answer at all on ethics and propriety and that payment from the local developer, Rishi Kapoor, which seems to be at the center of a lot of
this? I've been very transparent about that. I've always said from the beginning that I worked for that developer in a capacity that has nothing to do with City Hall. I'm allowed to do that. It's perfectly legal. And that's really the end of the story. I'm not so sure why that story got any legs beyond that, because anyone who would have actually taken the time to understand the facts would have been able to see that immediately.
See, it sounds to me like you think this local ethics body is going to clear you.
Yes, of course. I think they're going to clear me. It's because I didn't do anything wrong.
So you are going to be cleared of any wrongdoing or suspected wrongdoing?
That's my hope. And that's my expectation, of course, because I didn't do anything wrong. So I do expect, as long as it's done properly, absolutely, I expect the conclusion to follow the facts.
Got to ask you about cryptocurrencies before we finish. The first U.S. politician to take their salary in Bitcoin hasn't always gone smoothly. I mean, what does with a cryptocurrency, right? Here in Miami has its ups and downs. Miami Coin was that city-specific blockchain token that lost 90% of its value within a year. Why aren't you surprised that governments around the world are more wary of Bitcoin than you seem to be?
Well, I mean, it's, in my case, it's been a really good decision that I took my salary in Bitcoin, because I think it's up 100%. So I think that was a good decision. I think when when you go back to the moment of trying to be disruptive, and you go back to the moment of trying to create an ecosystem that serves the maximum amount of your residents, risk is a part of it. And risk doesn't always mean getting it right. Risk doesn't always mean winning. If it did, it wouldn't be risk. And I think there's almost an unfair presumption that when you're in public service or as a leader, you can't make a mistake. You can't get it wrong ever. You know what I mean? You can't. You have to always get it right.
So you're still all in on cryptocurrencies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, look, and it's not just cryptocurrencies. I think that's a narrow definition. I would call it, sort of DeFi, decentralized finance, or blockchain type technologies. And even blockchain is sort of limiting, right? So decentralized finance is a good way of putting it. Blockchain, sort of the whole, and crypto. Yes. Yes, I am.
Before we let you go, to go back to doing mayor things, we always ask our guests this, and we get some really good answers to this one. Who would you like to hear next on the Power Play podcast, sitting in the hot seat,
wherever it may be? It could be in the US, could be in Europe or beyond.
I know you've already interviewed Rishi from the UK. So he would have been one that I would like. So maybe I'll go back and listen to that one. Certainly, as a mayor in the U.S., Eric Adams is always a good interview. In New York, you have the mayor of Chicago, who's new. You have the mayor of L.A., who's relatively new. So I think those are all good mayors to interview. Politically,
should we interview Ron DeSantis?
Why not?
What should we ask him?
Oh, you know what to ask him. Don't ask me.
I'm interested in what you think.
He's
I should
to
ask
set me up. No, look, I think there's a lot of great things that you can ask him. But you can tell, you can ask him how great is the Miami mayor. That's what you can ask him.
Francis Suarez, thank you very much for coming on Power Play.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
That's it for this week's edition of Power Play from City Hall in Miami. We hope you enjoyed it, whichever side of the Atlantic you listen to your podcasts on. Next week, I'll be talking to the man who hopes to become Britain's next foreign secretary, Labour's David Lammy. If you'd like to get all of our episodes immediately they're published, do follow PowerPlay on all major podcast platforms. The team behind PowerPlay and this grateful host do enjoy your ratings and very nice reviews, so please keep them coming. 5 stars is our favourite cocktail, but I learn from all of your feedback. The senior producer this week was Peter Snowden. Kevin Hirshon assisted with the recording in Miami. The executive producer is Christina Gonzalez.
Today's episode is presented by Leading Into Tomorrow by EY. Dive into our mini-series, Granting the Future, for conversations with public sector leaders revolutionizing grant distribution worldwide. Gain valuable insights into innovative strategies and best practices, and discover how grants are shaping the future of public service delivery. Download the Leading Into Tomorrow podcast series today, available on all major platforms.